Okay, everybody, welcome back. We're about to hear from our practitioner panel. First, I'd like to take the opportunity again to thank Hogan Lovells and Chris Wolf for their sponsorship, and Ropes and Gray and Jim DeGraw for their sponsorship as well. We're very appreciative of that. I'd also like to thank again our wonderful staff, Louise Lee, Aaron Proudfoot, and Claire Trias, for working so hard to make this such a great event. And particularly, you know, you've heard that Chris Hufnagel and I are the co-organizers of the event. That's not really true. It's the staff that makes it happen. And in particular, they have a genius for minimizing our ability to do harm. And they do it in the most gentle way. I can only reference Jeeves and Bertie Wooster. So if you know P.J. Woodhouse, you know what I'm talking about. And they kind of keep us from messing it up while letting us believe that we are actually in charge. So thank you for that. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Chris Wolf, truly the Dean of Privacy Lawyers. Chris is a leader in this field. He's done so much. He's worked on so many interesting matters, and he has been so tireless in particular in building bridges among different communities, including academia, and so we're particularly grateful for that. Chris is founder and chair of the Future Privacy Forum, a think tank devoted to advancing responsible data practices. He's been called a thoughtful counselor, a tech titan, and I'm most pleased of all to say that he's a very dear friend of mine.
Thank you, Paul, very much. And we have a mutual admiration society, so thank you for that gracious introduction. I'm delighted to be back here. I think I've been here every year since the start of this program, and it gets better and bigger every year. And I think this is the best panel of all, of course. And I'm going to do a terrible breach of protocol. Instead of reading long introductions, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to actually introduce themselves and briefly, if you would, describe the role at your organization. So, Harvey, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Chris. I know that was nice of you to let us do it, I guess. Done it yourself, huh? I'm Harvey Anderson. I'm the Chief Legal Officer at ABG Technologies, a consumer security company with about 200 million users around the world. And I lead the compliance, the business affairs, privacy, and obviously all the legal and risk management functions. And prior to that, I was the general counsel and head of business affairs at Mozilla for the past 5 years. So that's it for me.
I'm Lothar Dietermann. I'm a partner at Baker McKenzie. I also have the great pleasure of teaching Paul's class this year at Berkeley to introduce the fifth edition of his textbook while he was preparing for this presentation here today. So that's a great honor. I've been teaching the computer law for the last 10 years, and it was a nice change to take on privacy at Berkeley this year. And I'm very honored to be part of this program here. I've also attended it in the audience before, and I think it's an excellent complement to the very many different seminars that are focusing on privacy these days, and the full room is evidence of the fact that it's a quite interesting and different approach than some of the other seminars have taken, so thank you so much.
I'm Will DeVries. Forgive my voice, a little bit of a cold today. I'm a proud Berkeley alum, and I've been practicing privacy law for about 10 years and since I graduated. And the last 5 years of those, I've been at Google, first in their policy shop in Washington, D.C., where I handled privacy issues there in 2010 and 11. And then the last 3 years, I've been at Google's legal department here in Mountain View and working on product advising on privacy as well as regulatory investigations and privacy compliance.
I'm Mike Hinsey. I'm Chief Privacy Counsel at Microsoft. I have been at Microsoft for 17 years, doing privacy almost all of that time. My work involves sort of a mix of internal compliance as well as working with our government affairs teams on policy matters related to privacy. And I also recently started teaching privacy law at the University of Washington School of Law in Seattle.
And I'm Laura Kehoe Hoffman. I'm the Global Director of Data Privacy and Security at Netflix. Pretty much do what it says on the tin. It's my 2-month anniversary with Netflix today. So yay me. And I've also written a book. I'm jealous of all the other people who have written a book. My book is about dragons and how to manage your emotions so you don't breathe fire. And I'm trying to get my children to illustrate it for me right now. So if I don't have any success with that and your kids are good at drawing pictures, please come and see me after the panel.
So as you can see, each panelist introduced himself far better than I could have myself. I thought it might be interesting before we get into practical tips from practitioners to hear where each of us came from. And I'm going to start it off. I was a generalist litigator for 20 years before I got into privacy in the 90s. And I really thought it was going to read on my tombstone, he died with his options open, because I was doing a variety of things and had the good luck of getting into privacy by representing a gay sailor who was being ousted from the Navy based on information the Navy obtained illegally from AOL and violating ECPA. We stopped that. And this is my doing well by doing good story. One of my neighbors in Washington read about that case and said, you know, I know a client that's looking for a privacy lawyer. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I think so. And that's how it all started for me. Harvey, how about you?
I guess I was I'm almost still going to admit this, but like many transactional attorneys, tech transactions, I was at a company and we sold mobile software, and one day we realized we needed a privacy policy, and I copied one from someone else and made some adjustments, and voila. I had a privacy policy now, hardly a long way from a privacy attorney.
You've come a long way.
Yeah, and then I spent 5 years at Mozilla and kind of got pretty steeped, and it made a lot of sense, the values that we articulated there around user control, user centricity, and privacy is one aspect of that. And that changed our world. We spent a lot of time on Do Not Track and other privacy initiatives that mix product and policy. So that's it.
Great. Lothar?
So I came to the U.S. in 97 on the e-commerce boom and got into all this excitement here. In the beginning, I wasn't admitted in California yet, so I was advising companies on how to take their products and websites and so on international. And on my checklist, I had privacy there as a topic. And at the time, the belief in Silicon Valley, which Edward Snowden confirmed for us recently, is that there is no privacy on the internet. And it wasn't a big part of my practice when I came here, but I'm from the German state of Hessen that had the first privacy law ever. It was born the same year as I was born in Hessen, so it was destined probably to get into privacy. But it came for me really out of helping companies with their going international topic, and it was just one of the things they had to think about. And since the Europeans had much more of a formalistic way to address privacy than the American companies, and we heard earlier on the panels what a challenge it is to convince management to do something. I think it really started taking off after Sarbanes-Oxley forced public companies to have a compliance program. Before that, compliance was something inherent in the law, like you pass a law so people comply with it, but now it's a separate discipline and people are trained for compliance and there's a budget for compliance and so on. So then it really started to become a big part of my practice. And since everybody's promoting their book, I thought I mentioned one too. So I have an international field guide to privacy here. It's my second edition this year. And Laura mentioned the illustrations have been a problem for her, so I did one myself. So this is my illustration.
So I feel like I'm on C-SPAN book talk.
But seriously speaking, I think one of the challenges for the U.S. companies has been the sheer amount of different laws and legal requirements that have been coming up all over the world. And there's so much information about it on the web that the toughest part right now for companies is to really focus on it and see what do I need to do, because they don't get to do everything that has to be done, and so that's a big challenge. And with that note, I think I hand over to the companies that have those challenges.
Yeah, and it's a good time probably to talk about my book. No, that's just I don't have nearly the patience for that. One thing that you'll find when you go work in house is that you can no longer read or write anything longer than a couple of paragraphs. So that's why we rely on outside counsel. It's not because of your years of experience. It's because you can actually read cases to the end. I haven't done that. I don't even know how to log into Lexis or Westlaw anymore. So I started out going at a tech company before law school, and I had absolutely no skills, but it was 1999 and it was San Francisco, and you didn't need skills. You just needed to be alive, and you could get hired at a tech company. And so I did, and I worked for a couple of years as a graphic designer and an interface designer, which I largely taught myself as I went along. And that was a lot of fun. And then I went to law school to fulfill my ambition of being an environmental crusader, and I found very quickly that environmental law is not actually nearly as interesting as technology law. Although you can do a lot of good work as an environmental lawyer, the law itself is not evolving the way, and the policy issues are not as forefront in the law as technology was. And taking actually classes and the clinic with Deirdre Mulligan, and taking classes in the with the professors that were there at the time, and seeing a talk actually on tech policy from Fred von Lohmann, formerly at EFF, now my colleague at Google, I said, I want to do what those guys are doing. That's interesting. That's definitely the thing to do. And privacy quickly became the issue that I focused on, and went to work at a law firm in Washington, D.C., where I lucked into a connection with a lawyer there who did privacy law, Becky Burr, and worked for her for 5 years doing privacy as well as other general law firm work, and then was hired to do something I had never done before, which is policy, public policy work by Google, which I think, to Google's credit, they hired me, but also it was probably a bad idea, as I learned after 2 years, that I'd rather be a lawyer than a lobbyist, and left the public policy side and came out to law. And I still believe this is the best time that there has ever been to be a privacy lawyer, and I feel like I'm at the best place in the world to be at a privacy lawyer, which is, by the way, a great thing for me, not necessarily the greatest thing for Google that that's the case, but it's still an enormous amount of fun. So.
So, Mike, I suspect you think you're at the best place to do privacy law right now.
You know,
I would say it couldn't possibly be as interesting right now.
Sometimes Will's job seems a little more interesting than mine.
Okay. First time I've heard Microsoft refer to Google.
Okay. We should have placed somebody in between the two.
No, they get along really well.
So my path to being a privacy lawyer certainly wasn't planned. When I went to law school, I was a ancient Greek history major and philosophy. And I went to law school because I wanted to go work for a human rights organization like Amnesty International or something and go save the world. And those are the classes I took through law school. I don't think there was a privacy law class when I was in law school. In fact, I'm certain there wasn't. And then I graduated and did a clerkship and had a bunch of debt. And I was engaged to somebody who had a job at what's now your firm, Chris. So I thought I would move to D.C. with her and ended up landing at a big firm there because of the debt thing. And ended up, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, but you know, they asked me what group I wanted to be in. I was like, international, that seems interesting. I should do that. And ended up working for this partner at Steptoe & Johnson who was mentioned in one of the questions earlier today, Stuart Baker, who was the former general counsel of the NSA. And he was representing a bunch of Silicon Valley companies dealing with restrictions on exporting encryption technologies. And so that's how I got sort of tied into the whole tech world. And, you know, I learned how encryption worked in order to support those clients. And then I got hired by Microsoft to be Microsoft's export control lawyer. In 1998, and in April of 1998, and then in June or July of 98, the Commerce Department liberalized the export rules, and my job kind of went away. But around that time, privacy was starting to emerge for us as an issue, and I sort of, people thought, oh, the crypto guy, that's security, right? That's similar to privacy. You can take that stuff. And I did, and I've been sort of riding that wave ever since, and it's just grown and grown and grown in importance to the company, and it's just a fascinating area of law.
And since we're speaking of books, Mike and I contributed to a book together in the 2000s.
That's right. I was thinking, God, I don't have a book. I don't have a book.
Everyone has a book.
I've got a chapter in a book.
We have a book. Right. Lara?
I come from a family of engineers, and in a fit of rebellion, I decided to get a degree in medieval literature. And then I went to law school because I had a degree in medieval literature, and it's not terribly lucrative. So I went to law school, and then that was wildly successful. And then I was in a situation one day, similar to Harvey, where somebody needed a privacy policy, and they're like, you like words? And you like lots of words, and you speak those weird words because you do the French and the German words, too. You should write it. It was a little bit more detailed than that, but so I ended up supporting writing a privacy policy, and then I was researching privacy, and I thought, well, this is really interesting. And as you may have gathered, I'm an extrovert, which means I like people and I like relationships. And so I sort of fell into privacy by accident, and I ended up staying because to me so much of it is about relationships. There's a compliance aspect, but there's also very much a relationship aspect and trust aspect. And that absolutely fascinated me, and I wanted to be the person who helped make you comfortable in sharing with me, and then to take that writ large, working for companies who wanted to make you comfortable sharing with them so they could share back with you in a positive and reinforcing way. And the medieval literature thing also explains the dragons, so I'm just going to bring that full circle.
That's great. I think one of the themes I hear through each of the panelists' stories of how they got to be a privacy lawyer is that when you started, you were generalist privacy lawyers. You were sort of taking every question as they came. And we've come to a day, to a point today where the questions come fast and furious, and they cover a lot of very specific issues and ranges of issues. We have health privacy, we have kids' privacy, we have international privacy laws. And so I want to ask each of you how your respective organizations are organized, and in particular, have we now reached a point of specializations, that there is no longer a general privacy lawyer, but there are privacy lawyers who handle specific subjects or specific slices of privacy law?
Okay, take a start. So ABG is a Dutch company, i.e. we're a European company, so privacy is a little bit different the way they think about it. It's a little bit more formalistic, at least when I joined. And we've organized it, though, at least from a legal perspective, is I've tried to embed the – actually, I might throw out an assumption. When we talk about privacy, I've tried to get folks to focus more on data instead of privacy, because I believe we're fundamentally in a sharing economy, and – most of our transactions are data is at the essence of those transactions, and privacy is a quality, but I think they need to think about data. So we have a product counsel function that includes data or privacy, as you may want to think about it, consumer compliance, all of the things, anything related to getting products to market and talking to users, anything about the user, and then versus a commercial function. And the corporate governance functions, commercial is all about selling our stuff, purely revenue driven. So I want so we've created a front end where the group of attorneys, I need them to be, you know, active, knowledgeable about privacy on a sort of a tier one support level. And then in the back of the group, that's much the back. There's also a privacy data expert that we have, who's based in Germany, who deals with sort of the more particular compliance pieces, and I think the framework that I like to think about it is, you know, merely complying with the law is not good enough for what we wanted to give to our users. So there's a legal compliance part, and that's all fine, but that's the floor. That's not where we stop. And so I need both our product counsel to kind of think about the value and sort of the trust equation and sort of protect that at the front end, as well as another compliance group that we have that also thinks about kind of our brand, our values, and our ethics. So the, you know, and I've also been in other places too where it's been very, you know, if you check the box, you comply with the law, then it's good, right? You know, you can do whatever as long as it's this. And so in our world, at least in our company, that's not the framework. I think of the legal part really as being the floor. And the value piece, where your chief privacy officer or your product counsel or other folks come in and actually set the tone for what you want your brand to represent and how you treat users. So.
Great. Lothar, you're in a private firm. Do you have specialists within the firm who have particular areas of privacy that they work on? Or how do you make assignments when somebody like Harvey comes in with a matter? How do you assign it out?
I mean, one of the things is that we would check whether somebody had already looked at that very question. The other area, so if Harvey came to,
right.
If Harvey came,
so knowledge management.
If Harvey came with a very specific issue, or if it's a litigation case or something, we'll certainly ask around whether somebody had already this identical thing. But other than that, I think the specialization comes through the industries that we serve. So we have a group here in San Francisco, Palo Alto. We deal with tech companies' issues for the most part. And then on the other hand, there is the employment group that deals with privacy in the employment sector. So that is the geographic specialization, if you will, in this commercial area. And we have people in New York that deal mostly with banking and finance type of things. And then the rest of the world depends on what the particular industries there are. They tend to have a heads up. We have in our firm, we have a steering committee that is global, and then we have a national one. We have 77 offices around the world. We have privacy people in every office. This has been a big focus for us from the beginning when privacy started becoming on the radar of U.S. companies. So we try to make sure that they are specialist privacy people. And there are now people that will get, just because they've done a few HIPAA advice cases for hospitals, they will get more of these cases and they will become more experts in that area. But it's not something that I would encourage too much, that I say I want to have a special HIPAA privacy group or a special financial service privacy group. I think whenever there is a trend or firms can make money, there's immediately this urge to create a specialist group and hold it out. I remember when e-commerce crashed, there were firms that didn't have a privacy practice at all. The next day they had 20 people who were privacy specialists. And if you looked them up, they were also corporate lawyers or litigators until that time. So I think we should resist those fads and make sure that we look at it internally, who spends more than 50% of their time on privacy, and those are the people that we copy on the emails to not waste other people's time.
So I remember forming a Y2K group in 1998. So
nanotechnology really group, home. Social media group, big data group, cloud group. The firms are very innovative.
But let me push back for a second. Don't you think we've reached a point, though, HIPAA, for example, which is incredibly complex and even more so after high tech, don't you think there's a need for people who just do that?
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And specifically, I mean, there's HIPAA for tech companies, which is something we do a lot here. And then there's HIPAA for
business
healthcare providers and for the covered entities, which is kind of a separate thing. So if I get something like that, I give that to a colleague of mine who works in the New York office and who is advising the insurance companies and the hospital and so on, because their issues are so different. If he has a question for a tech company to be a business associate and how to deal with, then he would send that to us.
So one of the things I wonder about is whether in the world of education privacy, which has gotten a lot of attention recently, and I think it's going to become more complex, in the world of wearables, are there going to be specialists in, for example, education privacy and wearables, where that's all they do, just like some of my colleagues only do HIPAA? That's a rhetorical question.
I hope not.
I mean, I think if there's too much specialization, the risk that I see is that people then take their discipline out of context for the company, and they will say, this is the most important thing, and we'll introduce them to a client, and they say, this is wearable, that's the only focus that you should worry about. I think there still needs to be a little broader range of business savvy advice, so you need to know your industry. The wearables, on the one hand, I represent two makers of wearables, and so I know that's very much on their mind, but when I work with companies who want to hand out the wearables to their employees and so on, that's not their top issue. That's one of the first 50 issues that they have to deal with. Whether the HIPAA applies, for example, to that, depending on how they give it out and so on, and how to set that up that it does not. And that would be something I think everybody needs to know who's worked on these implementations before. That'd be my sense.
So, Will, describe how you're organized, but also describe your view as a client. Do you want a firm that has specialists, or do you want, as Lothar described it, somebody who has a broader view?
That's a great question. I'll tell you a little bit about how my team has approached it. We have 10 lawyers and actually an opening on our team for here in Mountain View. Anyone interested, please let me know. And that's, I assume that's got to be one of the largest dedicated privacy legal teams in the world. And we're very, very, very busy, obviously, and we can't even handle the incoming. So what we try to do is be the sort of little privacy law firm within our 900-member Google legal organization, and really be the specialist. And we need the frontline product counsel to be handling the basic privacy issues, and if they come to us, they should be questions that they can't answer in their own day-to-day work. Otherwise, we couldn't possibly scale to meet their needs. And I kept thinking, when I was hired at Google, my expertise was I knew some about the FTC and had been through some investigations, and I knew a little about U.S. privacy law and ECPA and other things. There was a lot I didn't know about. I didn't know anything about European privacy law. I didn't know anything about financial privacy, health privacy. And I said, well, I'm at Google. I don't really need to know about those things. And every single one of those has gone down. Like, I've now, there's no area of privacy law that isn't relevant to some product that we're trying to make or our business operations around the world. So I think those have all gone down. We have to keep a kind of mastery of all of these things, although we certainly have people on our team who are experts on financial privacy. I've recently picked up a lot of the educational privacy. I'm learning about FERPA because I had to advise about this privacy pledge that my company and many others recently signed. So I
that originated with the Future Privacy Forum. Come on, if you can give a plug, give a plug.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in a very short amount of time, I had to learn about the background and education privacy. And to speak then to what we look for outside counsel, what's been very clear to me is having a relationship with a lawyer. And there's a handful, yourself, obviously, someone like Al Ghadari at Perkins Coie, and people who are just these people who know our business from soup to nuts, and they've been around, we've been working with them for a long time, they know technology, they know other companies, they don't necessarily know every single privacy law, but they're going to be able to, we can call up that person and say, you understand our business, here's what we're trying to do, help us figure it out, and they're going to have a roster of people to be able to turn to help filter answers through the knowledge of how our companies work. And where I've really run into problems with private practitioner or law firm practitioners is they often have a lot of expertise in the area that I'm asking them about, but not enough understanding of the business. And without knowing that side of it, it's hard to be a really good counselor to a company. So that's my how we've tended to use our outside counsel.
Great. Mike?
You know, we're structured very similar to what Will described and their second largest legal team in the world. but in terms of, you know, what we look for in outside, I mean, so seriously, I mean, we actually had a somewhat larger dedicated privacy team than we do today because I think privacy law has matured to the point where the frontline lawyers really do need to have a pretty sophisticated and relatively deep understanding of privacy as a general level because they're the ones that are out there working with the engineers, working with the product designers, and identifying the issues in the first instance. And so we've really had an effort to sort of push privacy expertise out among many, many more people throughout the legal department and throughout privacy managers within the business as well. Because it really is, it's not just a legal function. It's a broader compliance and really sort of product design function as well. But in terms of like law firms and stuff, you know, I think it's both. Will's I totally agree with you that you need to have people who understand your business deeply. That's really the key thing. And having some trusted advisors at firms that you can bounce ideas off of is super, super important. Behind those people, though, I think it really is helpful to have somebody who's really, really deep on HIPAA if you've got a HIPAA question or you know, has dealt with FERPA more than just once. Because, you know, I consider myself a privacy generalist. Some of the people I work with at firms are probably privacy generalists in some sense. But when you need to know, you know, how some agency has interpreted this subsection of this section of this statute, having somebody who's got that deep expertise sort of behind there that you can rely on is really helpful. So, I think law firms can offer both of those.
Laura?
Yeah, I just echo all the comments. I will admit that I know enough to spot a HIPAA issue and then I run screaming and call somebody who knows HIPAA very, very well to help me out. But yeah, I also consider myself largely a generalist, but with enough knowledge to help spot issues, and I'll just echo, I think it's really important to empower the other folks on the ground within your legal department who are working primarily with the product teams, with the marketing teams, and arm them with first-line information so they can manage things at that level. So the stuff that's percolating up is slightly more specialized or more nuanced, and that is the only way you can scale.
Can I ask Mike and Laura a question? So when things come up for you, for instance, Netflix, like a Video Privacy Protection Act question, or Microsoft, you probably deal with the similar questions, Mike, that we deal with on some of the laws that we know really well, like Section 5, given, you know, we've both had consent orders in our past. So going through those, do you find that you've got better expertise in-house in your lawyers there than you can find externally? I mean, one thing we've noticed is that what we really need from outside counsel is not an answer on does like this section of law apply to this product, because we've got the best people who know how that product works and apply that law in many other contexts. What we need is someone who can tell us, big picture, are we headed the right direction? Are we doing the right thing? Are mm-hmm. we too in the bubble to see properly what we need? Are we evaluating this risk correctly? We identified this legal issue.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit it on the head with that one. It's very easy to get within the bubble and think, okay, we know this, we got this. And what I would like to do, and I find this is it's an efficient way to work with outside counsel, develop a plan, and then take it out to your outside counsel and say, does this feel right to you? Am I missing something? Validate this for me. And, you know, I've had outside counsel say, this is right, this is right, this is right. Have you thought about this? On this aspect of it, and that's incredibly valuable. And to that point, you need somebody who both understands your business and understands the law enough to give you that open advice.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, as I said before, having sort of that trusted advisor who knows your business, who can sort of provide that big picture is really valuable. But I will say there are some, I mean, I think internally at Microsoft, and I know you guys too have some of the best privacy lawyers in the world in-house, and so oftentimes we're not looking for that expertise. Sometimes we're looking for that sort of big picture, another smart privacy lawyer who may not be drunk the Kool-Aid or been too far in the bubble, who can provide some perspective on that, and you know what they're hearing from other clients and all of that is a really valuable perspective. I will say that sometimes there is a need for true expertise that we might not have inside the house. You know, Canada passed this new, anti-spam law, and it's really complicated, and the regulator's still trying to figure out how they're going to interpret it and apply it. And dealing with outside counsel in Canada, who was close to that and had insights into how the regulator was thinking about it, is really valuable as well. So sometimes you do need that outside expertise. You can't be everywhere. Privacy law is so big now, you can't stay on top of everything.
So speaking of regulators, how important is it and to what extent do you interact with regulators as part of your practice, or simply to be informed about the direction in the law so that it will help you later on when a problem arises, either in-house or outside? And Harvey, why don't we start with you? Or actually, let's go to the other end first. Laura, we'll start with you.
Sure. Well, keeping in mind 2 months in, so that right. hasn't happened
but
yet.
Previously, you were not a desk before,
yeah,
so you can
yeah.
draw on that experience. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, in the course of my career, I mean, you will... It's good to get an opportunity to work with and speak with regulators outside of the context of someone's enforcing something against you. And there are events like this where regulators will come, and that's incredibly helpful because you hear what's on their mind, what's keeping them up at night, but you also hear about what's working. And regulators can often be very generous with their time. Well, they'll go on road shows and they'll come and visit and they'll want to sit down and talk with companies and have those face-to-face discussions. And again, just to be very open, and sort of gets back to trust and relationship building, right? If you're willing to sit down with the regulator and say, I want to answer your questions, how can I be helpful to you? You don't understand this aspect of our service, let me explain it to you. Let me bring someone in who can help explain it to you. And that works if it's privacy regulators, if it's the patent office. It works across the board. If you can be open and help people understand, things become more trusted and or less scary, because often people will be reactive to things they don't understand and therefore scare them. And so anything you can do to diffuse that is helpful. It also helps when regulators are using your services, because then they have the customer experience, the end user experience, and then often you can understand, okay, I understand what's happening here. This makes sense to me. I understand how to use this in a productive way. It's useful.
Although I remember a hearing about the VPPA where Senator Coburn was really, really concerned that somebody might know what he's watching. I wondered what he was watching.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah. Keeping in touch with and communicating with regulators can be really valuable and really important. And it's not just reactive. I think the proactive engagement with regulators you know, one, as you said, can help you understand what's on their minds. You know, I think also being proactive and developing those relationships with regulators, you know, can serve two other really valuable functions. One is ultimately, you know, having that relationship, they can start to view you as a resource as well. Yeah. And, you know, so when the phone rings and it's a regulator on the other end, it's not always bad news.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
you're not necessarily quaking in your boots until, you know, 5 minutes into the conversation. You can figure out whether it's a good call or a bad call. But also, you know, if you're preparing to do something and you're preparing to roll out a new product or a new feature that you think might raise some privacy concerns or be misconstrued in some way, getting in front of that and talking to the regulators before they read the blog post or before they, you know, read about it in the press and jump to their own conclusions can be really valuable, because then they understand what you've done, why you've made those decisions, you know, how you're addressing the privacy concerns. So it helps to sort of proactively get in front of those issues.
So, wait, Mike, that suggests, though, that you might be calling a lot, because every day there's a news story about particularly the larger companies. And so how do you decide when to try to go in and be prophylactic to keep them away, and when do you just sort of let the news cycle play out?
It's a good question, and it's more an art than a science. It's sort of a gut. Having been through this for a number of years, you kind of get a sense of the things that can go sideways, and it's certainly not a perfect crystal ball. Some of the biggest, you know, privacy stories over the last, you know, several years, it's not always predictable what those would have been. Sometimes things just happen in an unpredictable way. But I think sometimes you can get a pretty good sense of, boy, this thing could be construed in a really negative way. And those are the times where, you know, if you've got that little radar going off, it might make sense to
Laura
pick up the phone call.
Laura interrupted you, I think you were
going to
say.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was going to say, I felt like you guys did a really good job with that, with the Xbox One.
Because we were rolling out a gaming console that had a camera and a microphone on
it.
And we were asking people to put it in their living rooms and in some cases their bedrooms, you know. So that could go bad, right? So we wanted to get in front of that and tell that story.
Mm-hmm. So, Will, I see you at workshops from time, or I used to see you more, I guess, but your company certainly participates in workshops. Is that part of your interacting with regulators and trying to help shape the direction of public policy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Google went through the phase where I think many fastly growing tech companies go through, in fact, some that, you know, you can see kind of right now playing out, where you're developing a worldwide user base very, very, very fast, and all your effort is about scaling your business to handle it, and you're not scaling your regulatory interactions to handle that. And that comes across often as arrogance, as uncaring, which, you know, certainly there is some of that, but mostly it's just you just don't have staff. You don't have people to do it. And it's a lesson, you know, Microsoft's older company has been through. We are now through. We are on the other side of it. You see other companies coming to that place as well, that you have to have staff, not just in the U.S., but where your customers actually reside. And you have to be interacting with regulators, and not just when they call you in because you're under investigation. So, you know, that's definitely the case. And that's no longer my job. I say, luckily, it's not. I don't have to as my business, but I get to, with pleasure, interact with regulators occasionally, and when under good terms at conferences and at places like that where we run into each other. And it is always a learning experience. And taking products to them is difficult. Regulators are not the target audience for your products. I don't think any company up here would say that. So it's very difficult to bring company products in and preview them. You have to make judgments about what you need to bring in, when you need to bring it in, what you need to say, whether it's better to deal reactively or in advance. And you always have the problem of, you bring in a product to a regulator and you say, hey, this is how it works, this is what we've done with privacy, and they ask you to make changes, which is often completely impossible. The product's already baked, it's already in beta testing, it's not coming far enough along. You might disagree with those changes, no matter how strong your privacy by design approach is. You might just disagree. And so then if you launch a product that a regulator has told you they don't like, then you have a real problem. And actually, we went through something very similar to that with Street View in Europe. And still to this day, there's largely no Street View in Germany for that reason. We just, it never got kind of over the hump after kind of the initial, we paused it to say, well, we'll work out the details before we launch it. And as a result, there's no Street View there. You can say whether that's good or bad. Different people would have different opinions. But certainly that's, I think, from Google's perspective, too bad. We'd rather have that product exist in some form for German customers. So those are really tough decisions to navigate. And Google does not very often go in and preview our products. But we definitely will when it hits very, particular issues and raises issues that we know regulators have asked us about in the past.
Great. Lothar, is going into regulators part of your practice?
Yeah, and I want to add something. These are great presentations by companies that have been very sophisticated and where it's very important given your large presence and your high profile. So smaller companies often come and say, which regulators do I need to worry about? I cannot worry about all of them, and I'm still very small, and maybe it's going to be Microsoft or Google is going to be targeted, and what do I have to worry about? And I think an important part is that the council and advisor has to differentiate between regulators who publish a lot of guidance and regulators who are willing to actually enforce the laws. And I think that is something that changes over time, and that's something that I think Privacy Council have to be mindful of and really focus on. When I started practicing privacy law and advising more companies on privacy, at the time the Europeans were already publishing guidance, the Article 29 Working Group, and a lot of US lawyers with no European background wanted to advise on privacy, and they would just read from this stuff and to the clients and say, you have to worry about this and this and this. And I was thinking, they never do anything. That certainly changed in the last few years, and I think even then I would read the guidance, and I thought it was interesting and follow it. And some of the stuff I said, that's never going to happen. If you look at cookies, they always required an opt-in consent. Europe did never anything about it. 2002, published a new directive, said opt-down is enough, never did anything about it. There was no opting out of cookies ever. 2009, they come back and say, now we really want opt-in consent, and they still haven't done anything until last year. They started throwing it in with other complaints against companies that were on their bad list. So I think a very important point is to see which regulator is really going to buy it, and then, as Will was saying earlier, to figure out for a particular business, is this going to matter to you? If it does, are you going to be able to win that regulator over, or is this going to be bad in that country, which we sometimes have?
So one thing I will note is that the FTC generally has open arms to companies and to lawyers who call them up. I've heard European regulators say expressly, it's not our job to counsel companies on how to comply with the law and basically shut the door in their face. They view themselves purely as law enforcement.
Yeah, Chris, on this conference 2 years ago, the head of the Article 29 Working Group was the Dutch commissioner at the time.
Right.
And I remember asking him a couple of questions because his guidance was completely unreal. And he said, Lothar, I don't have the time to talk to you right now, but I'm going to bring an enforcement case and you can read about it in the paper. And I've seen him at conferences since, and I said, when are those enforcement cases coming? And he said they're coming forward. And last time I saw him in Berlin, he actually did bring a case, and he emailed it to me personally, which was nice.
Right, so we have you to blame for those enforcement cases. You kept poking them.
I think that was on his political agenda, and I certainly didn't ask him for an enforcement case. I asked him to learn from the FTC and be a little more embracing.
Yeah.
I was with the FTC at a meeting with enforcement authorities in Latin America, where I think for those of you who do business there, there is a good shakedown waiting for U.S. companies. And we had a closed session where we sat with all the privacy regulators of the different countries in there and heard their position, and they heard us on. There were a number of big U.S. companies. And that is a new, evolving, very scary scenario. They all watched how the Spanish authorities set up with no budget but huge fining powers. And privacy doesn't have much of a historic background there, so they have a lot of leeway. And the success of their organizations will depend on how much fines they collect. And the Spanish commissioner was there, too, to teach the former colonial friends on how to do this. And it was a 3-day seminar. And I think that is something that American companies totally need to watch. And some companies are on it and were there with us in the delegation. Some companies are not really following that yet because they don't know how harsh it's going to be. So just to add to those points is I think regulators are not regulators, and you have to see which ones are going to be really matter. And if you find the ones that matter, then I think make an analysis. Is it good to engage with them, or are they going to be, like you said, just going to be enforcement and I don't even want to talk to you? I want to advance my career by bringing a case against you.
Right. So, Harvey, you've been at companies that have featured privacy-enhancing technologies. And does that give you an opportunity to go in a positive way with regulators?
Yeah, it certainly does. I've spent a lot of time with regulators in the U.S. and in Europe and other places, and I view that, and I think it's very situational. It depends on what you are doing, as you said. If you're a company and that's a hallmark of your value proposition, you get viewed a little bit differently. But fundamentally, I view that community as stakeholders, just like there are other stakeholders, and mostly I see ourselves, companies, as a resource to them so they understand what's happening in the market, both to understand what's happening in the market and what's possible, because I think that's important for them to hear from us directly. And relative to the other question that some folks talked about, I mean, everyone has said so far is pretty accurate, and it has been true for me as well. But the other piece is there's other resources in terms of going in with products before launch. There are lots of other organizations to do that with, and counselors that you can talk to. And so whether that was, you know, we use CDT a lot to bounce things, ideas off of. We've used, you know, your firm, talk to you about things. You know, and sometimes we've actually had, we've talked to the folks at the FTC about ideas. And I would say that once you start that dialogue, though, you do kind of have to keep it up, because it's not a one-shot deal oftentimes with an offering that goes into market if you think it's going to change, particularly if it's new. So once you set the expectation, and it's just like with any relationship, you're forming a relationship. That's what you're doing. It's not I don't think of it as the regulatory piece. It was funny. Someone on my team the other day said, oh, no, we can't tell the regulators that because then they'll be on our ass all the time. And I just thought, no, that's not really the way to think about that. That's not a reason not to talk to them. And I think if you have a more open approach, particularly on the earlier side, and as Will said, if the product's about to launch and you know what it means to launch, it's kind of late to change things. But if you have input on the earlier stage, at least directionally, it can help.
Great. I want to play with some hypotheticals with the panel, and I think in the course of doing that, we'll get the answer to a lot of questions, such as what are some of the top issues you're addressing in your job today? You know, how do you counsel your senior executives and so forth? So let's start. Assume for the moment that your company is the subject of a forthcoming Wall Street Journal article. It's coming out tomorrow. And it quotes a senior executive as follows. We have the ability to know intimate details about our customers' lives from the data we collect, and that gives us a real edge in marketing to them. I can imagine we've been approached to sell our analyses to other companies because it works so well. So that's the quote, and it's now Friday night. It's coming out in the Saturday morning Wall Street Journal. What, if anything, do you do, or do you engage others to do? And when I say you, it can be your company if it's not your particular role. But what do you do to address the anticipated response from privacy advocates, from regulators, from plaintiffs' lawyers, and so forth? And Harvey, why don't we start with you?
Thanks. I have to say, I was just thinking, shit, did our CEO say that?
Besides saying, there goes my weekend, what else?
See in the paper tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm just checking if we said anything like that.
This is purely hypothetical.
Okay, sure, now. That's interesting. Okay, so what do we do? This happens Friday afternoon, so I call my significant other and say I'm going to be late. That's the first thing. Step one, maintain the primary relationship. I think we so that's coming out in the Wall Street Journal.
And you can't grab all the copies off the newsstands because it's online now.
So obviously we get the PR team in place. One, make sure that they're involved. Two, I probably reach out to some of the stakeholders that are in the industry in the privacy community, to give them context on what was said and to help them understand what we intended by that, because I'm going to assume the intention was good. So effectively, we're going to try to build support in other communities. Now, I'm assuming that the statement isn't just bold-faced. You know, you really are grabbing data and you're planning to expose people. So we're going to look for the best intention to put context around it and position it a little bit and get others to tell that story a little bit. And I think you're going to start trotting out all the things that you've done that have been good and privacy and protecting and that have been user-centric and privacy-forward. And there will likely be another story on Monday that you're going to release that talks about what you've done to sort of put some balance on that. And then I guess that another part of this is to, in the background, I would find out, is it actually true? Do we actually have such a product? Are we actually really commercializing that thing? Because people say all kinds of things, and there are so many things you can do with data, which doesn't necessarily mean, my experience, it doesn't mean that we're actually doing it. So it could be an errant comment. It could also be, yes, there's a product coming out in the pipeline, and that is what they're working on. It could be a labs project. And by the way, it could be all for good. That's the other thing. You don't know what that actually looks like. I mean, there's lots of uses of aggregated data that get some sort of sensitive, but it might be for a very good purpose. It's not purely commercialized. So,
I guess what I would add to that is, I think the very first step is to get the facts. I mean, figure out what the executive actually said. Is that an accurate quote? What did he or she mean by that? It talked about the intimate details. What are they talking about? You know, that's awfully scary sounding, right? But find out exactly what kind of data we're talking about. Find out what the selling it to others plan is, whether we've done that. You know, just find out what the facts are. And based on that, develop the good story that you can use to counter the Wall Street Journal article. Because there's the Wall Street Journal article, and then there's all the stories that follow up on that.
The blogs.
And maybe it's too late to influence the Wall Street Journal story. Maybe it's, you know, off on the way to the printing presses. But, you know, you can influence the subsequent stories. So get the facts, develop the good story. And sometimes that good story is we made a mistake. Mea culpa. We have this plan. We've looked at it now. We're not going to go forward with selling this data or something like that. Or maybe it's, yeah, this is right. We've got this great targeting program, but look at all these great privacy protections that have been built into it. So make sure you can develop that story and then get it out there through your own blogs, through outreach to advocates, through outreach to regulators, so that you can try to take control of the narrative rather than letting it play out without any input.
So is this where your relationships with the regulators that you've set up in advance by being at conferences and going in to see them in their offices and interacting with them comes into play?
Certainly, yes. Yeah, that certainly helps to have those relationships ahead of time with the regulators, you know, with the privacy advocates, with others, and that certainly can be valuable, especially when time is at the essence and there's a trust issue involved.
So to the other panelists, what are we missing? What else should you do in the wake of this impending news article?
I start making notes about tone coaching training I'm going to do with other executives. I mean, it's a great example of where use of one or two key terms could turn something that's completely benign and, in fact, helpful to your customers into something that sounds creepy and scary. So using the term intimate, probably not the optimal word choice. And the quote, if I heard it correctly, and to Mike's point, make sure you understand what the exec actually said. I think in the hypo, the scenario was, people may have come to us to ask us to buy this because it's so awesome. One possible statement back, assuming it's accurate, is, yeah, it is awesome.
We use it
for these awesome purposes. It's not for sale. And sort of having that, so again, taking control of that narrative and then working with executives to help them understand that certain terminology is more likely going to be a red flag. And other terminology is going to be viewed as a positive, and let's have a discussion about what those phrases are, and how we can stay on message and talk about have a positive message about our products and services rather than turn it into a privacy conversation.
One thing I would add, I've been on the receiving end of the Friday night phone call. Oh my God, the Wall Street Journal was doing this really actively about 2012 or so. They started having this bi-weekly
series. The What They Know series, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What They Know. And I remember I did get a call from a client who was going to be featured. And the client's reaction was, let's take a look at what we do and is this even legal? So we wrote the traditional memo, which they did not want delivered by email but hand-delivered only on paper. That's how critical they viewed it. They ended up shutting down this business unit. But the Wall Street Journal article did not come. It didn't come because the parent company of Wall Street Journal was doing something very similar at the time, and they had to look into that, which gave us a little more time to work on it. And I'm not suggesting that you should somehow put pressure on journalists. I heard recently that's not a good idea in the news, but that is certainly something that that I've actually seen in the workings. And I think that client and other clients, one of the things they could do proactively prepare for the good tips that Harvey and Mike have just been given, and Laura, in terms of putting out the positive message. I think that's companies, and many companies do that, should proactively have the answers on the edgy parts of their projects and their products. I think your company has been first public about having product counsel there from the very first day that you guys are working on something. There's somebody looking over it and giving some privacy input. And even if it is a product that might be totally okay here in the U.S., it may raise eyebrows in other countries. So I think it's a good idea to write up some kind of memo on what the facts are so that they are available in the crisis situation, and that early on the lawyer thinks about what should we call this product. I'll give a couple of examples. Is big data really a great name for what our analytics products are?
Right.
Is big government too big to fail? Big banks, big tobacco, why do we call this big data? Or cloud computing. Here in California, where we need a little bit more rain and snow, we think cloud's a super cool thing to have. And in Europe, they're just thinking you're not telling us where the data is and your minds are clouded and they have all kinds of negative associations. And I think we're making it worse for ourselves to go in that. If there had been some early consultations and thinking about what do you want to call things, what are your metaphors, what are your terms, and have a little bit of a fact documentation, and in B2B, share that with the customer, too, so that they get their counsel not up on the wrong foot. More and more, you mentioned the specialists, the companies that buy technologies and want to use them, insurance companies, banks, and so on. They don't know that much about technology. And if you want to sell something to them, I think you need to give them a good FAQ, how this is a good product, and not just say, I'm the tech company, and I have a cool name for this, and this is the latest out of the Silicon Valley, but you have to help them understand how they can responsibly use this, what problems might come if they don't have good procedures, because otherwise they'll be caught off guard by these kind of crisis situations.
So, Will, do you agree that privacy by design should also include crisis management by design?
Yeah, well, so I'm struggling with your hypothetical because it's just so far out there for me. I just have no context for what that possibly could be like. You know,
stretch your imagination.
Yeah.
If you
can. So, I mean, I've been through a number of sort of the crisis, the Friday afternoon call from the reporter. This is the story that we're going to do. Actually, Friday afternoon would be great. It's the Tuesday midday call that you get saying it's being published in an hour. And we certainly go into crisis mode. We all know how to handle that. It luckily does not. It's not the current, you know, the work mode that we engage in. And all of the PR aspects and all of the things that Harvey described, we have very talented folks to work on. It's, thank goodness, not my job. I would be pretty terrible at it. But there is then the digging in immediately afterward and saying, like, what's happening here? What are we doing? What's the real deal? And we get on that as quickly as possible. And being able to get things. One thing that I've discovered in a lot of these crises is not the quote from the CEO crisis, but the your product is doing X, Y, or Z crisis, is that often you learn about, that you can't believe what people are telling you when you go and talk to a product manager. You don't actually can't believe what they're saying to you because they often have an idea what their product does, and they don't really know. And there's been several times when you find out from a news story that something's going on, and you go and you get down to it, and you find out it's still happening. They said, oh, yeah, we took care of that bug a week ago. No, it's still happening. These are really complex systems, and they often don't know, and they need somebody coming down in an investigative way and in a comprehensive way to do a review to say, let's pull this all apart, let's make it happen. And we've gotten that system really honed. It was pretty sloppy when I was first working on it. I mean, You know, it happened probably less often because the company was smaller, but now when things come up, usually internally flagged, thank goodness, and not externally, there's a great process for getting to the bottom of it. And that has absolutely been part of the way we've designed a privacy compliance program, as much catching things in the beginning as quickly rectifying them when they come up afterward.
Can I add something that Will just mentioned? Not quite on the hypothetical, but that person that can validate what's actually happening with your products, we added to our team a privacy engineer, which made all the difference in the world, because that, and it's one thing to understand the law, it's another thing to have a great position on your values, but where are the bits going? Where is the data going? And so having someone that was almost an engineer first that understood that in the context of privacy built into your team, I found to be really, really essential, an essential resource that you could trust and that could actually validate where the data is going, what's happening. Because at this time, in that hypothetical, it's more the scenario of the product is doing this. It tends to be more damaging than X person said this. Mm-hmm. You can always walk away from the person, as you said. You know, that was a mistake, didn't mean that, we're wrong. But when the product's actually doing it, that's... it's doing it.
There was something Becky Burr, my old mentor and boss, said to me once when I started practicing in privacy, and we were doing our first investigation. It was involved AOL and search data, research set of search data that they put on the internet, which is my first big privacy private practice case. And I was kind of going through kind of what had happened, and we were talking about where all the data was stored. And she said to me as we were driving back from Yale's campus, she said, "Nothing is ever deleted. Everything's always somewhere else. Just wait and see." And she was right then, and I've thought of that many times. She's been right. I mean,
Does Hillary Clinton know that?
Yeah, exactly. But that's one reality about these systems are not designed to delete. They're designed to preserve. And you can make things that are not available in your business practice, which is good. I mean, that's, you know, when you have to honor, say, European law and delete users' data. But often you've got backup systems that you don't, in a regular business practice, use, and it's not user data that you could access and put into your back into your business. But you've got things for catastrophic events that you have, and there's always someplace else the data is. And I'll never forget that piece of advice, and it's one that I'm passing on to you all. It's always somewhere else.
Okay. They used to say it's not the crime, it's the cover-up, but your adage is it's always somewhere else. It's good to know. Let's just play with one more hypothetical and assume the statement was, instead of this statement about knowing everything about the customer's lives, it's a statement about data breaches. And one of the executives is quoted as saying, "We have data breaches all the time. Every company does. We'd be foolish to report every single data breach." How do you deal with that one? That's not necessarily a verifiable fact about a product that you can investigate and either refute or confirm, right?
First thing I'm going to do is call Harvey and say, "What am I supposed to tell my husband? Because our weekend is totally shot, dude. Give me some advice here. Help me maintain the primary." It's breach is a really interesting word, and you know, in the interest of finding out what the facts are, who is the exec who used the term? I mean, somebody who's having a poke at your system, right? But didn't get in. That's not a breach, but yeah, that's happening a lot.
So you bring in the executive and say, "What did you mean by that?" And then hopefully he says
Thing. Well, yeah, that's part of it. It's like understand what was the exec trying to cover when she said breach, and then you go from there in terms of clarifying, because again, you know, there's breach, there's security incident, there are a lot of words again that are very scary, but may or may not be accurate in terms of what's actually being described.
But yeah, I mean, that statement you said, there's a certain truthiness to that statement, right? in the sense that breach is a broad term, and leaving a cell phone in a taxi cab is a data breach in the broad sense. Losing a laptop is a data breach in the broad sense. Mm-hmm. And you can frame that sentiment that was given by the executive, and that executive probably does need that kind of training that you mm-hmm. talked about how you phrase things, because it sounded awfully cavalier and uncaring.
Yeah, right.
But you could convey that same idea in a much more mature and sensible way, in the sense that, look, the data breach notification laws have a trigger in them for a reason, so that you avoid the specter of over-notification, so that people are notified in the instances of breaches where they're at risk, where they can take action to protect themselves, and to in the broad sense, notify consumers, and everything that could be characterized as a breach would undermine the whole intent and the benefit of that. Mm-hmm. So you can frame that and restate that in a way that says, of course we're going to comply with the law. If there's a breach that requires notification, of course we'll notify consumers of that. And beyond that, of course we'll notify consumers when it's the right thing to do to protect consumers. But that doesn't mean that everything that could be characterized as a breach should trigger notification. If you can sort of pivot and recharacterize that statement in a much more sensible, mature, thoughtful way, then it's not so bad.
Okay, let's change gears for a second. I want to ask you about the relationship between your companies, or in Lothar, in your case, your clients, with the government. There seems to be a tendency among some tech companies to try to promote privacy through shielding data from the government. And maybe you can talk for a moment about that tension of, and Microsoft, of course, is in the middle of a case, the Irish case. There's some device encryption issues that have come up, where the FBI Director Comey has said that companies have a responsibility not to make data completely secure on devices. Comment for a moment, if each of you would, on this tension between protecting consumer privacy and the government's need to get information for law enforcement or to prevent terrorism, and comment on whether you think it's a serious problem today.
I'll start, since I sort of finished up on the last ones. For me personally, this is, I think, the privacy issue of our time. Which I realize is convenient, since I don't work for the government, I work for a big company. But it also is the one that's driven me and my personal views about privacy. And there's this great paradox that we have, which is that if you make it difficult for people to protect their data from surveillance, then the people who have the highest benefit to taking steps to protect themselves, who are willing to pay that cost, tend to be people who are doing things that you really don't like. But what you want is, you want everyone to be able to protect their information, to be free from surveillance if they want. You need to get past that leading edge of the terrorists, the pedophiles, the people who spend lots of time and energy hiding their behavior, to get to the regular population who have things to protect, but they aren't going to install Tor. They aren't going to do all of these very complex things. You've got to make it possible for them to do, and get it to be a consumer benefit. I really applaud what I've seen Microsoft do, what I've seen Apple do about encryption. These are great steps. I think, you know, my company's taking some good steps. I'd love to see more. And getting it to the point where everyone can use these things. The cost of that, and we all have to accept the cost of that, is that bad people are going to be able to do things and not be caught. And that's a really tough cost. And I feel very strongly, feel very badly for those in law enforcement, those in national security, who are trying their best and are very committed to trying to stop those bad things from happening. But by their nature, we are developing technologies that are enabling them for this reason that I described. And it's a paradox, and there's no clear answer. The problem is, and I'm very sympathetic to the U.S. government, the British government, other governments who are trying to protect us from really serious threats, that there's no really reasonable way for a global company to offer them particular protection and not offer it to China, to Russia, to others. And so for me, that's
something.
You
mean by that offering access,
yeah,
to the
government? Yeah, if you disable the protection from surveillance that you build into your product for one government, there's no limiting philosophy from that idea. And that's a tough place to be in, and that's the place we're going to have to be in. And the key is, how can we most help our societies and the governments that are trying to do the right thing and go after these bad guys, help them as much as possible without undoing the need for everyone to be able to protect themselves.
So don't you view it a little bit odd, though, that this debate is going on between the tech companies and the government and not in kind of the arena of public policy? You don't see Congress taking this up.
Yeah, we'd love to see, for instance, this isn't an area I work on personally, but I see it very much in my day-to-day, that the MLAT treaties that are used by foreign governments to request information from U.S. tech companies if they're based in the U.S. It's a broken system that involves faxing things going through embassies and such. It's just a broken old process. And so there's a lot of desire to say, oh, well, Google just hands stuff over directly to us if we're, you know, a government in a different country. That's not Google's problem that we can solve. We need the governments to solve that problem. And it's tough to be in the position of being asked to solve it for them, but that's the position that we find ourselves in and other companies as well. It would be really great if this could be happening on a government-to-government basis, and it is to some extent, but it needs to happen more directly, more publicly, and faster.
Other thoughts on this issue?
I would echo what Will said. I would say that the case that we've brought challenging the U.S. government access to data that's sitting in an Irish data center, we're focused on winning the case, but
that's the procedural posture of that right now?
It is before the Second Circuit right now. We lost in the Southern District of New York, and the appeal is pending before the Second Circuit. We're focused on winning that case, but part of the whole campaign around that has been to foster that kind of dialogue with Congress, between governments around the world, because we have a broken international system for dealing with these issues, and the result cannot be, at least we hope, and we're fighting against that, the idea that every government around the world can extend their extraterritorial reach worldwide. And so part of what we're trying to do is start that dialogue, so it's not purely between the tech companies and the governments.
Other thoughts?
I mean, from a policy perspective, certainly interesting, and as a society, we have to find our way in terms of acknowledging what the role of law enforcement and security services is going to be on the internet. We're used to being watched when we walk the street and the cop car comes by and we don't know yet, is a Google search more of a going on the street and asking somebody a question, or is this a conversation behind closed doors? And I think everybody has to work on that. You ask the question, what do companies do? How do they prepare for the situation? We heard from two tech companies that are caught in the middle between this. There's, of course, a lot more companies. So last week I was in Shanghai and met with some of the Chinese companies, and they said, well, all this brouhaha in the U.S. is quite helpful to us. Of course, the Chinese government has a totally different interest in controlling the internet. They don't do that much on the anti-terrorism stuff yet, but they would like to be able to censor more of what is going through and into the country. And they've already have a law on the book now that will require Chinese data to stay in China, or to at least be present also in China. Russia went ahead with legislation like that. We're doing a briefing next few days on this in San Francisco and Palo Alto on the implications of that. That will require all personal data to stay in Russia. The Russian government tells their people this is to protect it from the NSA, but the law doesn't really stop Russian companies exporting the data. It just requires them to also have it local. Brazil was trying to do something like that, last minute removed it. And I think companies have to watch this now and have to think about it, the architecture of their services. If this does go forward, then it will be the end of this whole idea of cloud and distributed computing resources. And I think companies have to watch where this goes. Not everybody can influence it. Some of you have a little better influence, but also not that much, as you acknowledge. And so companies have to watch this and see where this goes. At the same time, the governments are fighting over the U.S. over control over ICANN and over the internet. That's going to make a big change in the next few years as the U.S. is stepping back and release control there. And I think we might be looking at a completely different internet in the next few years if we don't all have a say on this and have our word in on that.
So we're going to go to questions from you all in a moment, but this is the lightning round. And I want to ask each of the panelists to identify the number one privacy issue that you're working on or most concerns you in your job.
I'll start. I'd say the number one issue is aggregate data and the notion of what's the appropriate use of aggregate data, with the assumption that it's aggregate, non-personally identifiable information, that it can be correlated with other pieces of data. So what does it really mean to say I'm using non-personally identifiable aggregate data would be for me, right? You're safe. But yet I'm dealing with a partner who then I know correlates it with some other ad ID or some other piece of information, and it's almost as if it's personal. So that, I think, is probably, I think, what a pretty interesting issue right now.
Good. Okay.
For me, the international transfers of data is, in my practice, the number one thing that clients have to deal with somehow. This residency thing to totally throw a monkey wrench into companies' plans, but even before that, it has been an issue that all the countries are passing data transfer restrictions, which is different from what the Russians and Chinese do, where they just require to be also in their countries. But they have data transfer restrictions, and the companies between data transfer restrictions, retention times, and then residency requirements have to really work on right now how they're going to structure their products, what the architecture is going to be, and how their organizations are going to deliver IT services, because this is going to be rapidly changing, and some of those deadlines are very close. And if companies want to stay in compliance, and most of them promise in their codes of conduct that they will comply with every law in every country in the world, they got to start cracking on changing their architecture and their organizations to live in that new world in compliance.
Right. Well,
So I think the top issue is the one we already talked about, which is the international law enforcement, national security surveillance. But that's not what I work on personally, so that's kind of a cheat. So I'll say the one that I work on personally, the biggest issue is compliance with the European Data Directive and the coming regulation. It's, you know, a big deal, and it will drastically change how privacy is regulated in the world, and already is, as the Europeans are ramping up enforcement, starting, of course, with us.
And do you think the regulation will be passed finally this year?
I have no idea. I would be welcome other people's thoughts on that. I hear that, I mean, I think within 3-4 years for sure. But that's just what I hear.
Mike.
Boy, you know, I was thinking the European thing too, but, you know, I'm going to punt a little bit and say there isn't one. You know, I think every day is different, and there are issues that come up on a day-to-day basis, some of which are not the sexy headline issues of the day. You know, dealing with how do you comply with the new Canadian anti-spam law? It's not that sexy. It's not Internet of Things or big data or cloud computing.
For Canadians, it's very sexy. But
okay. Well, you know, it's a low bar. sorry. Please don't quote me on that. But yeah, I mean, there are just so many things, and you know, those things that are the headline drivers, the Internet of Things. You know, we're starting to come out with wearable devices as well, and so those are obviously big issues as well. But it really does vary, and there's a vast, broad range of privacy issues that we deal with, all of which are important.
Laura.
Yeah, I'm going to echo Mike to a certain extent. I mean, and this sort of gets back to what we were talking about at the top of the hour with specialization. I actually think about the jigsaw puzzle that is privacy all the time, right? And if what impact are data transfer restrictions going to have on the business, the co-location or data localization requirements, pseudonymization and de-identification to the extent that can take you out of the coming regulation or take you out of some of these laws and therefore allow you more flexibility. And I think it is important to watch very carefully how all these dots are connecting. And the way I think of it is you've got a set of pebbles in your hand, and you're throwing them into a very still pond, and you're going to have ripples. And the ripples are going to run into each other at some point and negate each other. And if you think of all these different developments as the stones and the pond is your company's business, how are you going to be able to navigate as those ripples run into each other? And as Mike said, it's basically a moving target. So having that holistic overview and being able to stay focused on that, I think, is going to be increasingly important for all of us.
Great. Now let's go to you all. Do you have questions for the panelists? Sir.
Yeah, hi. Full disclosure, I'm actually a physicist.
The last time I was surrounded by this many attorneys, I was working, I was surrounded by 8,000. I was the chief scientist for the Department of Justice for a number of years. So I've also been coming to this conference, for about 3 years. I love it. This is the first time I have heard the issue of law enforcement access to data come up. I'm delighted to hear that. It's a very difficult issue. I work with a lot of law enforcement. So my question to you then is, some of the things we talk about is the extension of the CALEA requirements that are on telecommunication providers sort of expanded to a broader realm of providers, some of the internet users and things like that. I'd like to hear your comments on that. The CALEA, of course, requires that the telecommunication companies be able to provide information when requested.
So we may call on Jim Dempsey to answer this one, too, because he's our resident expert, I think, in the room. Jim, well, actually, you want to take your crack at it? Sir? I got you all off the hook.
No, it's like we could do, obviously we could do and maybe should do a whole conference on CALEA. The basic issue, for those of you who don't know it, is in 1994, Congress adopted legislation which imposed design mandates on telecommunications carriers to design their, basically for the mobile and landline telephone companies to design their switching equipment in order that it be wiretap friendly, in essence, to, in the name of preserving law enforcement access to real-time communications. Congress limited that to telecommunications carriers, which at the time were basically five companies and three switch makers. In 2005, the FCC, by rule, expanded that to broadband access providers, basically the cable companies, which had already adopted their own industry standard for what's called lawful intercept. Now the question is, should that be extended, in essence, to the application layer? So it basically the transport layer is covered, and it's basically covered worldwide. Most countries, certainly coming out of a publicly owned telephone infrastructure, have similar requirements. And so the debate ongoing now is, with a variety of challenges that law enforcement faces, primarily the proliferation of services, the plus encryption, so you have sort of an intersect between the tremendously much more complex communications ecosystem, and now, finally, something that we hadn't seen, everybody talked about, we hadn't seen for 20 or 30 years, which is now the much more ubiquitous implementation of encryption, of whether it's HTTPS or other forms of end-to-end encryption. There is a push by some in government, in our government, to extend the design mandates to some wider range of services and even perhaps arguably to any service that transmits or processes or holds data to ensure that when the government comes calling that the information can be there. The government has full legal authority to get anything from anybody. The question is there the technological capability to provide it? And obviously in the case of end-to-end encryption, the middleman would say, I'll give you what I have, but it's an encrypted stream. So this is going to be a huge, huge debate, and as I say, could be the subject of an entire conference. The FBI director was out here a couple of weeks ago. I assume he talked about this to companies. Companies have pushed back. I mean, in part, the Tim Cook comments that were alluded to on one of the earlier panels was a very firm pushback by Apple against that. And, you know, talk about a very, very hard issue. This is clearly one. It's a very different environment than it was in 1994 when, as I said, literally you had three switch makers, one of which Nortel had already cut a deal with the Mounties to build it into their technology for $10 million. Nowadays, obviously, we have a vastly more complicated environment. So I could go on forever. You've, You've stuck the probe into that part of my brain, which is the Kalia part of my brain, and I could go on forever.
Well, I knew who to whom we should turn, and great question. Other questions from the audience? Over here. Sure, go ahead. Sorry.
This is going back to the hypothetical, maybe the second one about the great company that has this great business model about getting into the intimate details of their customers. So on that business model, I was also interested. I've come from UC Berkeley. I'm doing privacy at UC Berkeley. So I was very interested to hear, Will, that you said you were boning up on FERPA and that you signed, that Google signed the Student Data Privacy Pledge. And so I wanted to ask about reconciliation of the business model. Google Google's great business model and competitive advantage is building a massive corpus of data about everything that's done and doing amazing things with it, and reconciling that with the Student Data Privacy Pledge of not allowing amassing or creation of profiles except for educational needs or educational purposes, especially when I have the problem, and I think others do, of cross-pollination of my various accounts, my business account, my Google Apps account with my personal accounts.
Yeah, sure. So I've been learning about this a lot. I didn't know too much about our offerings to education before I started getting into it, so I could figure out what would be our compliance with the pledge, how that would work. And one of the commitments that, so we have this product called Google Apps for Education, which is Gmail and Docs and Calendar and the apps. It's also got a search product built into it, et cetera. And one of the commitments they had made before the pledge was to serve no advertising at all in that product and not use any of the data for advertising and marketing purposes. I actually hadn't known that until I got into it. It's you're right, that is different from Google's general model. I think the idea is this is something that people are going to demand for products that are used in schools. That's the market need. It's also what the business wanted to do. And, you know, someday those kids won't be kids and they'll be adults and hopefully they'll like using Google's products. That's the business angle. I'm sure there's also just an angle of saying, this is not an appropriate place to put advertising. There are products like YouTube, which kids can view and still have ads. And you know, we've taken certain steps to make sure that the ads don't involve, you know, behavioral targeting in those situations. We just released a kids YouTube product, actually, which is the first, I think, kids-focused product from the major social networks. But it doesn't allow a login. It's very hard to figure out how to actually allow people to log in and use that product, compliant with COPPA, in school context, compliant with both COPPA, FERPA, now the pledge. So I think advertising is just a really difficult model to see how you would make that work in a school environment, and Google's choice is just to not do it. There are, you know, a lot of opinions on this. A lot of what I knew before that I'd learned hearing from Chris Hufnagel, who talked a lot about Google at UC Berkeley, and I actually learned a lot about stuff. I think he has a different opinion probably than I would have, but I think that it's really interesting to figure out how we're going to use these cloud services, which everyone's going to use. There's no question. You know, there's a little quote from Jerry Brown when he was talking about having a watch on your phone. This is back in the 70s, a phone on your watch. And he was saying to a group of students, you know, we're all going to have these phones here, and everyone was riled up saying that's an invasion of privacy, that's terrible. And he's like, look, I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just saying we're all going to have one. I wonder what he thinks today about the Apple Watch. But we're all going to do everything in the cloud. That's how it's going to work. The problems with that, I think, exist, and they're manifest. There are major benefits. That's why we're all going to do it. But we're going to have to deal with those problems. One of them is when everything's in the cloud, obviously you centralize a lot of risks that otherwise would be very distributed. So while you improve security overall dramatically, you also introduce new security problems, which are really hard to figure out. And when there's a breach, the breach is catastrophic, or it could be catastrophic if you're not careful. Similar with privacy. You're sharing documents in an environment, or sharing emails in an environment where it's all being held by a central server. So the access to the central server is no longer, you know, in a file in the district office or in a room in the district office. I think that's better for security generally, better for privacy generally, but it contains its own risk. So I think we're going to have to worry about those for a long time. We went through a lot of this as we did compliance with the pledge, I think on the advertising part, the story was very clear. They just decided not to do it. On the other pieces of the pledge, we actually have very strong processes already in place for all our products around security, around access to information, the ability to delete information, all that kind of stuff, which flowed right through to this product. So I actually think it's pretty interesting, and we'll have to see how it takes on, but it's we're at the very beginning edge of these products being used in schools. So.
And the profile mapping part too, then?
Yeah, so that when I first took a look, you know, being, again, speaking for myself here just as a privacy lawyer, I looked at that provision and I was like, how on earth do we comply with this? And I went back to the product team and I walked through all my compliance effort and found out that they disabled a lot of systems in order to comply with that. I mean, part of Google's approach to dealing with consumers is that we collect information from across our services and we try to use that information to make all of the services work better for everyone as well as to deliver personalized service to that person, holding even aside the ads question, right? So the pledge requirements require that profile information be amassed only to serve the educational needs of the student or with the clear consent of the users. And so I went back and said, how are we complying with this? And they said, well, we're keeping this information in a very limited way and using it only in this product. And that's unusual for Google, but that's the approach that they chose to take there.
I think we had a question right here.
To the whole issue of the relationship between the government and Silicon Valley. We also had the director of the NSA come and speak, and we had the president come and speak asking for more cooperation and getting pushback. And it seems like every time, if they do acknowledge the current lack of trust, they are very careful to ascribe it to the Snowden revelations, not to the underlying practices that were revealed by Snowden. So is part of the problem here that there's no acknowledgement of what I think a lot of companies and a lot of attorneys in Silicon Valley see as overreach in what was actually done. And as long as there's a lack of acknowledgement of that, then that whole collaboration can't move forward.
So we don't want to turn this into an NSA panel, but if anybody has a quick comment on that, that's fine. Or no comment is fine, too. All right, thank you for that. Other questions? Okay, one more dying question? All right, if not, I want to thank Harvey, Lothar, Will, Mike, and Laura for being great panelists.